Fasten your seatbelt, turn up the radio. We're going on a road trip. Walk deep into the north woods of Wisconsin late at night, with the full moon shining and the shadows of tall pine trees casting flickering images of shadows and light on the underbrush. And listen, you may hear the sound of fairies, elves, gnomes, and spirits. Perhaps the spells of witches and wizards, of Native American medicine men, and in the sound of rushing water, mysterious and even frightening creatures. I'm Glenn Moberg, and today on Route 51, we explore the myths, legends, and long-forgotten stories recaptured and retold in a book, Blue Men and River Monsters, Folklore of the North. The stories were carried into Wisconsin from the old country by the first settlers, and they would have been lost were it not for the Depression-era Federal Writers Program, part of President Roosevelt's New Deal, which sent dozens of skilled storytellers across our state interviewing the last people of their generation and preserving the tall tales and culture of the North Woods for future generations. And it's all there in a book entitled Blue Men and River Monsters, a collaboration by Michael Edmonds and John Zim, published by the Wisconsin Historical Society Press, and they will be our guests today. On Route 51 today, we'll be retelling those old stories and the history behind them. We also want to hear from you. Are there old stories that are part of your family's history, passed down from generation to generation, that you'd like to share with us? And what do you think of the New Deal programs that put unemployed writers to work? Programs that were criticized in their day, but which today provide us with a wealth of knowledge about our Wisconsin and our American history and culture. So please call us at 1-800-780-9742. That's 1-800-780-9742. Or you can put a comment on the Route 51 Facebook page, and I'll read it live on the air. Joining us right now is Michael Edmonds, who did a lot of the research for this book and wrote the foreword to it. Michael, tell us about these stories and the Depression-era writers who saved them so that we could view them all today.
Sure. Thanks for the opportunity, Glenn. Most of us have heard about the WPA, the Works Progress Administration, during the New Deal in the 1930s. It was a government-funded program to put unemployed people back to work. And we think of it in terms of the CCC and state parks and reforestation. But they also employed literary people and artists. As you mentioned in the intro, the head of the WPA was criticized for this, and he answered that criticism from reporters with the phrase, "Hell, they have to eat too." And so late in 1935, in every state, a federal writers program was set up to give work to unemployed writers and artists and clerical workers, because, of course, then there was no electronic way to create and deliver information. So there's a whole lot of typing and carbon copies and filing that had to be done for these projects.
And again, this was the height of the Great Depression. There were a lot of people out of work at the time.
It was. It was 6 years into the Depression. And, our recession several years ago was compared to the Great Depression, but it's not really a fair comparison. Many, many more people were facing starvation then than ever did 10 years ago.
How many of these workers did we have in Wisconsin, these writers and stenographers and so on?
At its peak, when it first got off the ground, there were more than 100, about 140 staff in offices scattered around the state. It started in the fall of 1935, and by the following spring and summer, there were offices in Green Bay, Milwaukee, and Madison doing lots of activity. The legislation called for offices in every town of 10,000 or more, but Wisconsin never reached that level of density of federal writers program workers. I don't know if any state did.
Now, a gentleman named Charles Brown headed the Wisconsin Writers Project, and he hired Dorothy Miller, who was a 39-year-old single mother. Tell us about the two of them and what they tried to accomplish together.
Well, Brown was the head of the State Historical Museum here in Madison, and he had been traveling the state for decades, doing archaeological digs and making ties in local Native American and white communities. He knew everybody all around the state, so he was a good choice to run the program. The main goal of the program was to create a travel guide to each state. So he was supposed to create the Wisconsin Guide, but the instructions that came from Washington said these guides had to include the voices of everybody, including lots of people who had been left out of travel literature in the past. And that meant people who had oral traditions and folklore, working-class people, ethnic minorities, and people who generally had not found their way into print before. So Brown turned to a single mother here in Madison named Dorothy Miller. She was 39, and she had been a radio producer and done marketing kinds of writing. And he assigned her the task of running the folklore section of the Wisconsin Guide Project. She quickly assembled a team of about a dozen people, most of whom were women, working women. And she referred to her staff as the girls, even though there was one man on the staff. And they started by combing printed literature. They went through the great newspaper collections at the Wisconsin Historical Society, and they went through books and memoirs and so forth. But they soon exhausted the folklore that they could collect from there and started traveling around the state to interview elderly residents. And that's where all of the stories in the Blue Men and River Monsters book come from.
Now many of these people that they interviewed, they still remembered Wisconsin during the 1800s.
Oh, they did. They certainly did. They were interviewing elderly people whose memories stretched back to the Civil War and who could repeat the things that their own parents had said in the 1830s and 40s. So it was a living tradition, and Brown's vision for this was that these had to be captured before they disappeared. This was an oral tradition that would just vanish if it wasn't put down on paper.
You know, and we're still doing oral history projects at Wisconsin Public Radio, so that tradition lives on. And there is a real push to get some of these folks to recall their thoughts before they leave us, because once that happens, unless it's written down, they're gone forever.
That's right. Genealogists appreciate that. They do a lot of oral history with elderly family members. But listeners today need to remember that until 10 years ago, there simply wasn't a way for common people to get their stories recorded. Today, because of the web, people can push things out very easily to an audience. But before that, it just wasn't the case. And people who were working class or otherwise not connected to the establishment that produced information, connected to the media, had no way at all of preserving their stories.
Now, a lot of these tales were brought over from the Old World. They interviewed a lot of settlers from Switzerland and the Scandinavian countries.
That's right. And these were some of the stories that, you know, probably dated back hundreds of years in Europe, and they took on Wisconsin incarnations during the 19th century that get recorded in Blue Men and River Monsters.
Now, they also wrote down stories about Native American legends and medicine men. How did they find these people to interview and get them to go on record?
Well, there were two sources. They actually did talk to American Indian elders. I think it's people from the Menominee Nation are in the book. I haven't double-checked that overnight. But they did speak with some elders directly and record their stories. But a lot of the American Indian stories that are in the book are recorded from the descendants of white settlers. And today, of course, if we wanted to collect and preserve American Indian culture, we'd go right to them and help them do it. But back in the 1930s, people didn't have that level of sophistication. So one of the interesting things about the book is to look at how these white settlers warped and twisted what are central parts of traditional Native American culture.
So you've got an interesting mix there of Old World and New World stories, both Native American and people who were immigrants, isolated communities in the Wisconsin of the 1800s. Does all of this make for a good breeding ground for the creation of folklore?
Yes, it does. We can't really appreciate it, those of us alive today, because our culture has been homogenized since mass media, since television, particularly in the 50s and 60s. Those of us of a certain age can remember when there were vast regional differences and the South was nothing like Wisconsin. But today, you know, we're all going to go out and see Star Wars in the next week or two, and we're all going to consume the same thing. But back when these stories were being saved, that wasn't the case at all. Every region produced its own culture of this sort.
Why are these stories being revealed now? What did you have to do to retrieve them?
Well, Dorothy Miller and her staff took notes on them, which were then typed up and edited and smoothed out, and those paper copies went into their files. At the time, they published three or four very small books that were distributed only to public libraries, and a few of the best stories saw print that way. But most of the files just went off to Washington during World War II when the WPA ended. And there they were microfilmed by the Library of Congress, and we acquired the microfilm sometime in the 60s or 70s. And it's from the microfilm of the original papers in the file cabinets that this book was created.
And you say your role, of course, in putting the book Blue Men and River Monsters together was a collaboration with editor John Zim.
Yes, my job here is to be in charge of digital collections, and my staff scanned the microfilm and put all of these field notes from the 1930s online. Your readers can explore them to their heart's content. There's thousands of pages. And John went through and chose the very best stories for the book and interpreted them.
And John is on the line right now. John Zim, the editor of Blue Men and River Monsters. Welcome to Route 51, John. So glad to have you here.
Well, thanks so much for having me today.
You know, John, we've been talking about the stories that are in the book, and primarily so far what it took to record those stories. There are also beautiful woodblock print illustrations in the book. I'm wondering if either of you can talk about that.
I would love to, if I may here. With the book, we always want to have some sort of illustration. And when I was reading through the accounts, I really wanted to have artwork that was appropriate for the time period, and it just so happened that I stumbled across the title of a book called Superior Wisconsin and Woodblock, which for me is really struck a chord in two ways. One, I taught myself how to do woodblock printing a few years ago, so it's something I really enjoy and catches my eye. And also, I grew up not too far from Superior, so I thought, how fantastic. We've got artwork that is from, my neck of the woods, a medium that I really enjoy, and that was done through the Federal Art Project as well.
Oh, so this was also federal workers who did the woodblock prints.
Exactly.
John, you edited that book. As Michael just said, you're the person who picked out the stories. What made you think that a story was something that you wanted to put in the book? What struck your eye when you were going through all of this material?
Quite a lot of it, to tell you the truth. There was such a variety of subject matter that was covered. And really the only stories that I didn't include were some that were pretty repetitious or too short. Or there was also a few stories in the collection that had been previously published elsewhere and then copied down by the Federal Writers Project workers. So those I winnowed out as well. In some of the reminiscences at the back in the last section of the book, dealing with the festivals and food and dress and whatnot, a lot of the interviewees gave pretty similar information.
Well, let's look at some of the stories that made it into the book. One tradition came from Scandinavia, and Michael, correct me if I'm pronouncing this wrong, Hasgardria, is that correct? Am I?
That's John's call.
John?
Oh, as far as I know, that sounds good as I could say it.
All right, so this is on Christmas Eve, and we've got people or things that live underground emerging in flocks and going from place to place in the North Woods, howling and screeching, making a lot of noise. And John, you've got one story in the book brought over from Norway about a farmhouse that was haunted by these creatures on Christmas Eve and a traveler who saved the family from them, including one fellow who had three heads. Tell us about that.
Right. Oh, that's probably one of the more unusual stories in the book. And, like you said, imported from Norway. And I think maybe the best thing I can say about this is that this is part of a pretty long tradition of telling stories about this manner of mythical creature. I'm just flipping to it in my book right now. We see in this, and then the story about the blue men, some sort of tension with a mythical beast and some kind of solution or you know, a way to break the magic that is that they bring with them.
Yeah, the traveler in this story ends up sleeping above the fireplace in the old house where all these creatures came in, and then he ends up shooting the character, the three-headed thing. It doesn't say which of his three heads he got shot in, but that apparently was enough to break the spell, and the good Christian farm family could move back into their home.
Right, right. And, you know, with the story of the Blue Man, the savior of the story, a hunter, only had to fire a silver bullet over the head of this woman who was enchanted by a Blue Man who was being forced to marry, or was going to force her to marry him. So.
This lady, Rebecca, she was interviewed in Alvern in 1909 when she was 80 years old, and she claimed she actually had an encounter with a Blue Man in Wisconsin at the age of 15 when she was herding sheep and goats and preparing for confirmation. So that shows you how far these stories go.
Right, definitely.
What were the Blue Men? This is something that you just don't hear about today.
Yeah. Again, this is a Norwegian legend, and they're a subspecies of a type of fairy that were particularly fond of farm animals and used to like to come out and look at them and whatnot. And they got along well with humans, according to legend, as well, unless some harm was done. Of course, the big strike against them was that they would kidnap pretty girls and force them to marry them.
And Michael Edmonds, this story, these stories, was it just about the old world, or did these early settlers think the Hasgadsdria and the Blue Men would also emerge from our Wisconsin woods at times?
Well, when they arrived here, they brought with them the view of the world that they had had in the old country. And naturally, as they started looking around the woods and fields of Wisconsin, they were looking out for the things they had known about in the old country. I'm not able to judge how long those traditions lasted within the Wisconsin setting. UW folklorist Jim Leary certainly would know that stuff off the top of his head. But they certainly lasted the generation of the immigrants. And then they gradually get replaced or supplemented by homegrown traditions.
And another tradition that's in the book is the waterman who lives in the depths in Wisconsin and tries to drag unsuspecting victims into the water and then put human souls into an earthenware pot. Tell us about that, John.
Right. Yeah, another story that's kind of far out there. Waterman, like the stories of the river monsters, the monster sturgeon, are, of course, stories that people, when they told them, they knew that they were not being, serious or not trying to convey something factual. But to me, really shows the imagination that people have always had. I grew up on the South Shore, or pretty close to the South Shore of Lake Superior, and it's not hard to imagine, terrible creatures living underneath the surface of water, which you can't see.
Well, Michael, John just said a lot of these stories weren't really believed by the people who told them, but I got the feeling that some of them were.
Well, of course, it's hard to say today if somebody in 1860 really believed this or not, but the example you just had of the waterman could have been, I was just looking in the book, that doesn't seem to have an attribution of what country it might have come from, but it echoes beliefs of Native Americans that are recorded in archaeological evidence for 1,000 years and more, where they divided the world religiously into three segments. There's the world that we live in and we know through our senses, and there's an upper world inhabited by spirits and souls, and a lower world. An entrance to the lower world is often through lakes and waters, and some of the effigy mounds that we see around the state that depict water creatures are meant to signify that. So, in fact, when Marquette and Joliet in 1673 headed across Wisconsin. They were warned by the Menominee, don't do it because there are horrible creatures under the lakes and rivers that will capsize your canoe and eat you. So, it's not simple. Did they really believe it was true or not? There's an intermingling of different traditions, and individuals would have put a different amount of credence in each one.
And one of those Indian stories of river monsters, the Waupaca water monster, we of course have the Waupaca chain of lakes, which supposedly swallowed an Indian family whole. John Zim, very reminiscent of the story of Jonah and the whale.
Right, yeah, definitely. Waupaca water monster didn't seem to give up the bodies of those as easily as the whale that swallowed up Jonah. But another terror lying where we cannot see.
And then we had a monster sturgeon story in Lake Winnebago, which would eat elk and deer whole. Finally killed when it. When its eyes, I guess, were too big for its stomach, it ate an entire elk, and they found the dead sturgeon with elk horns protruding from its stomach.
Yeah, what a way to go, huh?
And those are both, Glenn, examples of tales that may have had Native American origins that have been passed a generation or two through white families and come out in a way very different than an American Indian elder would have told them to the WPA interviewers. So they're fascinating, just fascinating. And I think if your readers are interested in Native American stories, that's where they should go. They should go to those books that take it right from those people's mouths and not rely on what, you know, a third-generation German immigrant told the WPA interviewer.
And what I found interesting, too, was the story of the Wisconsin Dells. In a Ho-Chunk legend, the Wisconsin riverbed apparently formed by a giant serpent who smashed the large rocks with its head to form the Dells. So there's all kinds of interesting things here. What I found interesting, too, was the Ojibwe and the Sioux back in those days were bitter enemies in the 19th century. And there's a story about the Ojibwe being protected from a Sioux war party by a medicine man who surrounded his group with a white cloud, making them invisible. Michael Edmonds.
Yes, yeah. I read that one recently. Yeah, certainly that animosity is well documented and goes back several centuries. The ability to create illusions like that or to create mystical events like that is found all through Native American religion and various narratives collected. Again, I think the best place, if readers are interested in that, is to turn to the Indian materials themselves rather than these second- and third-hand versions.
And then up north in the community of Spread Eagle, there's a story of the magic lodestone, a stone that was so highly magnetized that it drew to itself all objects made of metal, even sucking up a Dakota war party that was armed with metal weapons. And they have yet to find that stone.
That could have, John, you may know about this too, that could have originated in stories about a huge boulder of copper that was reported to exist on the shores of Lake Superior, where copper was mined thousands of years ago by the original people there. And then in the early 19th century, Americans went and tried to find these copper deposits. And there are many reports in the eyewitness accounts of these early miners that there's a huge stone, a great boulder of copper, worth millions, which no one ever found. And so that, you know, those two stories could be linked somehow orally.
They did find that huge boulder of copper. And then there are stories about witches. Mr. and Mrs. Fred Hefty from Belleville shared a lot of them from 17th century Switzerland. A lot of them of particular interest in the dairy state. You know, if a cow is bewitched, it wouldn't give milk or calf anymore. If somebody comes and knocks on a barn door, you shouldn't open it because the stock can't be bewitched unless the witch sees it. So you could see how a lot of that would originate in the old country and still be a part of folklore and tradition here in Wisconsin.
Sure, and then after that, you get wonderful ghost stories. I was just looking at that section you chose, John, of the native Wisconsin-born ghost stories.
Yeah, John, tell us about that. That one of the lady in the brown dress. Apparently, she died in childbirth, and the apparition came back, and they would see her sewing in an upstairs bedroom late at night.
Right, I'm just you know, listening to the story now as we speak, and yeah, again, let's see here, refreshing my memory. The the ghost stories again. You know, I found particularly fascinating because.
You know, those were stories that originated in Wisconsin. They didn't have to be brought over from the old world.
Right, right, definitely. Yeah, and again, you know, there's that synthesis too between you know, the old world and the new, because you know, a lot of the immigrants have brought their particular beliefs about you know, life and death and you know, what comes after.
That particular one, Glenn, if I remember it right, from La Crosse or Eau Claire. Was told to the field interviewers as a true story. They really remembered this. There were multiple witnesses of that woman in the brown dress, and they found her very reassuring. She was not scary at all. And that's very different from, say, the inherited folklore about witches and ghosts that people's parents had brought from the old country.
John, we want to thank you so much for joining us as the editor of this book. We're going to let you go now, and... thanks for going through all of this and putting these stories together. It's just a wealth of information for anyone who wants to know about some of the legends and some of the stories of old Wisconsin. Michael Edmonds will return after this break. The book is called Blue Men and River Monsters, Folklore of the North. I'm Glenn Moberg of Wisconsin Public Radio. We'll have more magical stories from the old North Woods when we come back. Here's Gordon Lightfoot.
You could read my mind, love, what a tale my thoughts could tell. Just like an old-time movie about a ghost from a wishing well. In a castle dark or a fortress strong, with chains upon my feet, you know that ghost is me.
Contributors to Wisconsin Public Radio include Wollersheim Winery and Rockweiler Insulation. You too can help ensure the future of WPR with your business sponsorship. Find out more at wpr.org/sponsor. Support also comes from attorneys Sturgill and Long, serving the legal needs of the elderly and their families throughout Wisconsin and the Michigan Upper Peninsula. Information is at 888-613-0600.
She's some kind of demon that's hidden through. If you don't watch out, it'll speak to you, to you. What kind of fool are you? Strange brew can work so sad.
As Cream takes us into our second segment of today's Strange Brew of Witches, Warlock Spirits, and Mysterious Creatures of the Old North Woods, we welcome back Michael Edmonds as we discuss the book Blue Men and River Monsters. I'm Glenn Moberg. Thanks to John Zim, who also worked on the collection and joined us in the first part of the program. Once again, we want to hear from you. Are there old stories that are part of your family's history, passed down from generation to generation, that you'd like to share? And what do you think of those New Deal programs that put unemployed writers back to work, programs criticized in their day, but which today provide us with a wealth of knowledge about our state's history and culture? Give us a call at 1-800-780-9742. That's 1-800-780-9742. Or put a comment on the Route 51 Facebook page, and I'll read it live on the air. Michael, much of the Depression-era writers, much of what they recorded were also stories about real-life people and places in Wisconsin.
Right.
You've got an entry there about Smoky Falls, which was told by Mrs. Angus Lookaround. Now, that certainly sounds like an Indian source, about a waterfall on the Wolf River on the Menominee Reservation, and she believed that you could still see the smoke from the pipe of an ancient Indian wise man in the mist coming off of that waterfall.
That's one, Glenn, that I'm not familiar with. I'm just popping it open now. It does look like she's a Native American informant from her name. And, of course, there were many falls and many stories about specific locations in the landscape in Native American culture, and they were inhabited by characters and personalities of different sorts. I think that in this section, assuming that she is Menominee, that you can probably trust this as being an authentic version of something that her people believed at the time.
And there are a number of entries about John Muir, the famous conservationist, and his inventions. I hadn't realized that he was an inventor, along with being a biologist. There's one told by a Jerry Kearns of Hickory Hill that he put locks on a barn door that only he could unlock. Nobody else could figure out how to do it.
Yeah, he was really clever. We think of him as this mystic, you know, riding out hurricanes in the tops of pine trees and the founder of the Sierra Club. But he also was incredibly clever, and he made all sorts of devices out of wood at a time when power tools hadn't been invented yet. We have one at the Wisconsin Historical Society lobby, which was a desk he made for his dorm room when he briefly attended the University of Wisconsin. And it was set up to a clock, and it would wake him up, and then it would pull a book off a shelf and open it to where he had preset it, and he would be allowed to read that book by the machine for a certain period of time, and then it would rotate, and it would go pull another book, and he'd have to do that book for them. So he could build all sorts of things with his hands.
Yeah, it mentions in the book that an invention, without being very clear about it, that apparently threw people right out of bed first thing in the morning. You know,
yeah, this was something he made for himself. That it was like an alarm clock, but instead of making a noise, it tipped the bed up at a 45-degree angle and dumped him on the floor. And when people heard about it, they wanted to see it, and he would make them sit down and get thrown onto the floor.
Well, good morning. As a boy, he invented two clocks and a thermometer, which he brought to the 1860 Wisconsin State Agricultural Society Fair in Madison. And apparently he wouldn't let his kids go to the public high school. He wanted to teach them himself.
Yes, he was we think of him as kind of a gentle guy, but he was something of a draconian father. He had daughters, and he was very particular about what he would allow his daughters to do and not to do. He had moved out to California by then.
And there are other stories about early pioneers and settlers, including a story of the lost tribe on the St. Croix River. This was told by a storyteller from Grantsburg. Apparently, a band of Ojibwe refused to settle on any of the established reservations in northern Wisconsin near the village of Dogtown on the St. Croix.
Uh-huh. Again, this is one of those stories where you're getting a poorly informed white version of events, and I'm sure that if you talk to any of the Ojibwe in that area today, they'd probably have a different version. some of that may have been occasioned, some of the stories may have been occasioned by the fact that there were disputes all through the second half of the 19th century about what were the boundaries of tribal lands and what were not. And, of course, with the Ho-Chunk, who were also in northwestern Wisconsin or west-central Wisconsin, there was no reservation. They were legally supposed to go out to Nebraska, and thousands didn't. They came back and were always on the run until the 20th century.
Right, right. And, you know, some of the stuff in the book is a little bit mundane, but still an interesting window on some people who are pretty famous today. Paper Baron Fred Weyerhaeuser apparently lost his fur cap. He had a sealskin cap that ended up being taken by one of his workers while he was on a log run on the Jump River.
Yeah. He was quite a character himself, and there are multiple stories about him. But he was not well liked, and logging camps were made up of. There were in every logging camp, there were people who were misfits, who didn't obey the conventions of polite society, and that story about his cap is one of them.
And we've got a Rip Van Winkle tale about the lost Swiss man, a man who recently came over from the old country. He found a cave, entered the cavern, and didn't come back the next day or the day after, and then finally he returned 50 years later.
Yeah, this is a motif that you find in tales, of course, all over the world. This version is from south of Madison, and supposedly this fellow pursued a wolf into an opening under a fallen tree, and the roots were penetrating back in toward the cave, and he couldn't get out again, and he came up miles away days later, dazed and disoriented, and didn't know who he was or where he was, and went off to, ended up working in northern Illinois for a couple of decades, two or three decades, before finding his way home again, before realizing who he was and getting home again. And he came back and was treated like Rip Van Winkle.
And the book Blue Men and River Monsters also has a segment about someone near and dear, I think, to both of our hearts, Eugene Shepherd, a Rhinelander area showman, kind of a P.T. Barnum of the North Woods, who created the legend of the Hodag, which is still Rhinelander's mascot. He put together this contraption with wires and lights for the state fair.
Yes, yeah. Gene Shepherd was actually an immensely talented guy. He was a good businessman. He made and lost more than one fortune. He was a great map maker. He gave the names to more than 200 lakes in the North Woods. So if you have a place on a lake in Vilas County, it's very likely that he was the one who gave that lake its name. His maps were taken as perfectly accurate and used as the plat maps until companies came along to make their own. But he was also an inveterate practical joker and a liar and a plagiarist. And his most famous prank was claiming that he had captured a live hodag and exhibiting it at the 1896 Oneida County Fair. Hodag was a mythical animal that lumberjacks talked about that looked something like a cross between a wild boar and an alligator, and it was said to roam at night and eat lumberjacks who ventured out, and it was a tale used to terrorize the newcomers to any logging camp. So lumberjacks all knew about it and knew it was a joke, and he claimed to have captured a live one, and with the aid of a friend named Luke Kearney, they made a taxidermed one up out of animal parts and logs, and it had to be kept in the dark because and people couldn't be allowed to see it too closely because it was so dangerous. And Shepherd was a good ventriloquist, so he made it howl, and people came to see it and paid money to come see it. And the fair did pretty well on that. It did so well that it got press coverage, and in other parts of the country, the press reported seriously that a hodag had been discovered by science, because at the time, new discoveries were coming in from all around the world of species that were not known. And when that came out, Shepherd finally said that, no, it was just a hoax. And then people still paid to see it because it was the greatest hoax had been perpetrated.
But believe it or not, Michael Edmonds, maybe you've heard this, the real Eugene Shepherd was the subject of a Scooby-Doo cartoon episode.
I did not know that.
It's called The Hodag of Horror, and I have found, honestly, I have found a brief clip of it. What you're going to hear is the character, the Eugene Shepherd character, and he calls himself Eugene Shepherd. You'll hear him as a carnival barker unveiling the Hodag of Horror, and I think you'll hear a Shaggy of the Scooby-Doo cartoon call the whole thing a ripoff. So listen closely. Here it is.
Hi, Gene Shepherd, my very own traveling cabinet of curiosities from the primitive wilds of Wisconsin. I give you the Hodag of Horror!
That has to be the fakest looking monster I have ever seen. Come on, Scoob. This place is a ripoff.
Michael, that's the first time you've heard that. What do you think of it?
Oh, yeah, now I have to go look up and see who on the crew of that television show was from Wisconsin, because that's clearly somebody from northern Wisconsin who found their way to Hollywood and worked that into the Scooby-Doo show.
Now, Eugene Shepherd was also instrumental in popularizing the Paul Bunyan legend.
He was. He was a timber cruiser and a logging camp foreman, and in the mid and late 1880s and into the 90s, as he traveled around logging camps in the north, he told stories about Paul Bunyan.
Well, you wrote a book about Paul Bunyan, so I want you to hold on to that thought. We're going to talk about that next on Route 51. Our guest is Michael Edmonds as we talk about the book Blue Men and River Monsters, Folklore of the North, edited by John Zim, published by the Wisconsin Historical Society Press. I'm Glenn Moberg. Michael will be back with us after this short break. But first, here's Jimmy Buffett.
But all the stories we can tell, if it all blows up and goes to hell, I wish that we could sit upon a bed in some motel.
Supporters of Wisconsin Public Radio include Peninsula Players, Ganchert Nursery, and Marshfield Clinic, proud supporters of WPR programs. Your business can join our ever-growing list of contributors. More information at wpr.org/sponsor. Support also comes from Christine Bremer-Moogley of the personal injury law firm Bremer & Trollope, committed to protecting the rights of accident victims throughout Wisconsin. Bremer & Trollope, because the right results matter most. Bremer-Law.com.
Well, he picked up his axe and he chopped a tree clean down with his forward swing. Got him another when his axe swung back that timber cutting thing. He kept on a chopping the livelong day, and then when it was night, he walked back over the stumps he cut and stomped them out of sight. Thanks, Paul.
Well, nothing.
Paul Funyuns.
Well, that unfortunate bit of musical history came from Walt Disney Studios, which turned the legend of Paul Bunyan into a cartoon. I'm Glenn Moberg. Today on Route 51, we've been discussing the folklore of northern Wisconsin with Michael Edmonds, who collaborated on the book Blue Men and River Monsters with editor John Zim. And in our final segment here, we want to look at how folklore actually gets created by talented and imaginative storytellers like the people behind the tall tales of the world's tallest lumberjack, Paul Bunyan. Michael.
Yeah, that clip that you just played from the Disney cartoon, an interesting thing about that is the fellow who's the voice of Darth Vader, I'm just blocking his name right now, is the narrator of that cartoon. It's from 1959, 1960, and that's one of the starts of the beginning of his career. But by then, Paul Bunyan was nearly 100 years old. Everybody in the country knew about him. But in 100 years ago from today, in 1915, nobody knew about Paul Bunyan except lumberjacks. There was a phase when lumberjacks told these stories out loud for about 20 or 30 years in the woods. And then during World War I, they begin to escape into print. And in the 1920s, they're not children's stories, but adult fiction, and they become immensely popular. The two classic books about Paul Bunyan from the 1920s sell more copies during the period between the wars than the Great Gatsby sells. So it just seized the American imagination, and it's only in the 30s and then after World War II that Paul Bunyan becomes a hero of children's books.
Well, apparently when, you know, these are lumberjacks telling these stories, pretty rough people around campfires in the 1800s, when those tall stories were put into print, some of them had to be censored.
Yes, yeah. It was illegal to print things that we see in mass market television commercials today. The laws were quite different. And obviously, if there are 30 or 40 guys spending 5 months alone in the woods all winter long, they're going to tell dirty jokes. And if their hero happens to be somebody who has a very large anatomy, some of those jokes are going to be about a part of male anatomy that whose size is mythical.
Yes,
but
Paul,
they don't ever make it into print.
Paul Bunyan was a big man. We were talking about Gene Shepherd. Now, this Rhinelander showman put a lot of these, worked real hard to publicize Paul Bunyan. He even said that he created the tales himself, but as you said, he was quite a liar.
Yeah, there is some circumstantial evidence for this, though. For my book on Paul, Where the Stories Come From, called Out of the North Woods, I looked at archives from Seattle to Boston and looked at all the unpublished records of people who talked about Paul Bunyan. And the very first source, the oldest source, is from just north of Rhinelander in the winter of 1885-86. And there are, in fact, two independent sources of it. And Gene Shepherd was the foreman of a logging crew in that area the winter before. So it could be that he did make up Paul Bunyan. The Bunyan tales are classic tall tales, full of exaggeration and logical inconsistency. They're just fabulous.
The story about the Round River,
kind of mind.
The Round River, for instance, the river that just goes around in a circle.
That's right. Has no outlet. Yeah.
And then a lot of stories about the extreme cold of the North Woods. One winter, 63 below zero, the flame in the lantern froze, and the only way to put it out was to break it off and throw it out the window.
That's right. The book Out of the North Woods has more than 100 of those stories that are from the oral tradition. They're not the later things that were printed by advertisers and professional writers.
And
they're great.
And Paul Bunyan was a hunter. He invented a shotgun that could shoot geese so high that by the time they fell to the ground, they were generally spoiled.
That's right. So sometimes he loaded it with salt to preserve them on the way down.
And he rolled cigarettes out of 200 pounds of tobacco and tar paper.
That's right. Took two guys to keep his shovel, his pipe full when he smoked a pipe.
Yeah.
They just goes on and on. And they start with the minds of semi-literate working class guys really risking great danger in the woods. To be a lumberjack was a tremendously dangerous thing. And so it's not odd that they like to talk about a hero who could solve every problem.
And there's an example of how folklore is created. We have this legend that was created really, you know, during the time of recorded history, right at the turn of the last century. Michael, I want to get a caller in. Don has been waiting patiently. Don, you're on Route 51.
Hello. A few years back, I had a tall white pine in the back of my yard, which was north of Wausau, and I wanted to have a gentleman cut it down. It was close to 100 feet tall. And he explained to me that a lot of these white pines get hollow in the middle, and that's why they eventually die off and break and come down. Anyways, he told me that there was some people or a guy that he knew or had heard a story of they were cutting big trees down. I don't know if it was in the forest or where, but they came across one tree, and as they were cutting it, they hit metal. So a lot of times there's tree spikes or stuff like that in the wood. And so they thought, well, let's just move up a little higher on the tree and start cutting again. And they hit metal again. So the third time they had to go up, he said, 7 feet up in the air, and then they cut it, and the tree came down. And then they looked inside where it was hollow, and they had discovered that a gentleman had died in there with his musket. He had I think it was a regular musket from the Civil War era, he thought. He wasn't sure if he was in a battle or not, but he figured that there was a crack in the wood, you know, in the tree at the time.
And the tree grew around him.
That he crawled into to stay warm and probably froze to death, and nobody ever found him until years later on.
Don, thanks so much for the story. We've got to let you go, though, because I'm down to my last couple of minutes here, and I want Michael to respond to it. Thanks so much for sharing that, though.
That story about the petrified man in the pine tree has been told for at least 100 years, some version of it. And it's usually a French explorer or somebody who was with Marquette and Joliet. And back in 1924, the head of the Wisconsin Historical Society published an article that contained all the different versions and
yeah, go on, Michael.
Why they should be debunked. So I would have been happy to know if Don actually saw this thing himself. But it didn't sound like he did.
It sounded like it was secondhand.
Yeah, it's great that motif's still alive.
Michael, you write in your book, in the Paul Bunyan book, folklore arises in a community isolated somehow from mainstream culture, whose members all take for granted certain customs, beliefs, songs, sayings, and legends. Are we Americans still creating our own folklore today, or has technology, the internet, the shrinking world made the kind of cultural isolation that folklore depends on a thing of the past?
I think it's made it more rare, but we certainly have communities that share those kinds of basic assumptions about life and put them into artistic form. Modern folklorists study all sorts of things about modern life. So I don't think it's over. I think that people will always create these things, and wherever they bond together in a community, they'll create unique things. You may never see it on television or on the web, but we're still doing it.
Michael Edmonds, thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
We want to thank today's guests, Michael Edmonds and John Zim. The book Blue Men and River Monsters, Folklore of the North, published by the Wisconsin Historical Society Press, as is Michael's book Out of the North Woods, The Many Lives of Paul Bunyan. You can find out more at wisconsinhistory.org. I'm Glenn Moberg. Thanks to our executive producer, Dean Kallenbach, and our on-air producers, Jane Ritger and Lori Frazier. Thanks to John Altenberg for the Route 51 theme. Special music today by Paul Dukas, Peter Ilyich Tchaikovsky, Gordon Lightfoot, Cream, Jimmy Buffett, Walt Disney, and Edvard Grieg. Next Thursday, Christmas Eve, Route 51 is taking the day off so we can be home with our families. We invite you to tune in the following Thursday for our annual year-end review show, highlighting the best interview segments, feature stories, and live musical moments from the year 2015. Remember to follow us on Facebook. If you missed part of this show, you can hear it again in its entirety Friday night at 7 on WHRM 90.9 FM Wausau. Thanks for riding along with us today. Forward, as we say in Wisconsin, and until New Year's Eve, we're heading out of town.